Okay, questions. Love Don't
talk
let me down.
Radio.
I'll stay there.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a book, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis, and it's MJ Network. MJ Network in memory of my sister, Marcia Joyce. This is going to be so much fun and exciting. So listen very carefully. A West German nightclub owner goes behind the Iron Curtain on a desperate mission to save his brother in this Cold War thriller. West Germany, 1949. Former actor Max Kasper suffered greatly in the Second World War. Now he owns a nightclub. And the rest, you're going to have to listen to the show because I'm not going to tell you what happens when. Well, you'll see. Good morning, and how are you? Steve Anderson, welcome to MJ Network.
Good morning to you, Fran, and thanks a lot for having me here. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's cheering up my day, that's for sure.
Oh,
so,
good.
Tell us about Max and Harry, and how does he become involved with the search for him and the ransom note? And I'm saying, like, wait a minute. And I sort of caught on fast, but you know what? Tell them about him and how he got involved with his brother.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, this is part of a series. This is the fourth in a series, although I hope it reads as a standalone. But Max Kasper and Harry Kasper are two German-American brothers, and they've been separated by World War II. Harry is the much younger brother by about 9 years. Max is the older brother. Their family immigrated to the United States in the late 20s, and Max was trying to become an actor in New York City, but he did a really stupid thing. He thought his chances might be better back in Germany because he was more German than American. His German was native. So he did a really dumb thing. He immigrated back to Germany in 1939, which was a bad year for doing that, as we all know, as Hitler invaded Poland in September, and then Max was stuck there through the duration of the war, and bad things happened to him in book one. So meanwhile, Harry is the Americanized younger brother, and he grows up, comes of age in America. English he speaks as natively as German. And by this point in their two stories, it's 1949, like you said. Max has gone through some terrible things during the war, which we can talk about later if there's time. And Max is finally in a good place through Harry's help. Harry had been a U.S. occupation official. Max finally is comfortable. He has a little nightclub in Munich in the Schwabing district called the Cuckoo Nightclub. And he's finally getting what he wants to do. He'd always wanted to be an entertainer. And so he's got this little club. He's trying to forget about the war, the things that happened to him. Meanwhile, his brother Harry is continuing his efforts to basically, he thinks he can change the world. Harry's pretty headstrong. And he's gone missing behind the Iron Curtain. And basically on page one or two, Max gets this news, and it's this inciting incident that, you know, launches the story and forces Max to jump out of his comfort zone and realize, I need to save my brother. He's the one who saved my life. So by the end of chapter one, Max is off and heading to Vienna to pay what he thinks is a ransom for Harry to some kidnappers. But that's really just the start of the whole journey.
Well, what's exciting is that you put the ransom thing on page seven, people. The book's in front of me. That makes it even better. And then you told it in different timelines in different countries, which made it easy for me to follow. And basically, whenever I finish reading a book, nobody could read it, ever, because I underline, circle, cross out, and write little notes for interviews and stuff like that and for my reviews.
Sure, sure.
So, but I'm going to give it away anyway because my doctor's wife wants to read it because she gets it anyway.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, please do.
And that's how you get an appointment without having to wait. So explain his interview. Now, that must be hard to deal with a ransom note. So how does he interact with the people that sent him the ransom note? Well, he thinks sent him the ransom note anyway.
Yeah, well, he goes to Vienna. He takes it upon himself. He takes some money. He gets some documents because, you know, he still has a debt to Harry and the Americans, and so he can check in with the CIA people in Munich and got what papers he needed. They don't know what he's doing, but he goes to deliver this ransom note in Vienna. By the way, I should point out, I'm a huge sucker for period movies from that era, The Third Man and all those kinds of noir espionage things. And so I was very very happy to put this in Vienna where it's occupied by the four powers. So Max ventures into Soviet side of Vienna, and he meets these kidnappers who, you know, upon first meeting were very, very cocky and sly. And when he comes and delivers the ransom note, they are anything but that now. They've clearly been shooken up. And Max, by his standards, is now acting very aggressive and almost violent because he learned he has this side to him during the war that he doesn't really like about himself. You know, he wants everyone to get along. Mm. But now he wants to help his brother, and he's shocked by the fact that these kidnappers have been basically roughed up, and the Soviets have actually supposedly taken Harry and taken them behind the Iron Curtain further. So I'm kind of giving it away there, but it's one of those things that you do when you write books, you know, you almost get your character to the goal and then you yank it away from them. So that's what's happening there.
Well, there's a lot of people that are not what they seem to be in this book. I know that because it says it on the back cover. So it says he takes a quest to Vienna, to Prague, to Soviet East Germany, Communist Poland, which is not exactly how I feel about that. And along the way, he meets a whole bunch of horrible people. And plus, he meets somebody else. So, but there's somebody that's directing the action. His name is Sleep. So why does he direct the action? Why does Max have to go where he tells him to?
That's a great question, friend. Aubrey Slate is a character who actually first appeared in The Losing Role, the first book in the series. And I can tell a little bit about that if that's okay. In that book, Max, because partially of his acting skill and his knowledge of English, is recruited into this desperate espionage mission and forced into it actually by the SS during World War II. And it's based on a real life operation where Germans were sent behind the American lines during the horrible, bloody Battle of the Bulge. Max was forced into going, and he's supposed to impersonate an American officer, and he has no choice. But if he tells the Americans who he is, then he'll be surely hung or shot as a spy. So he's really caught between a rock and a hard place. And he's, in the book, he's actually caught between the front lines in the snowbound house. And who shows up but the counterintelligence corps, which are this American group who were actually hunting down these Germans dressed like Americans. And the counterintelligence corps official who is stuck in the house with Max is Aubrey Slate. So They have a past, and so Max is indebted to Aubrey, and Aubrey Slate also appears in The Lost Kin, which is the third book of the series right before this one. Mm. And by that point, Aubrey Slate has become basically a case officer for the early, what became the CIA, And so he's kind of like a guardian angel. He's also a kind of a case officer for Max and Harry. And basically, I think I can give this away. Slape intercepts Max early on and kind of redirects him in his efforts to find Harry.
Well, you're lucky that he did, maybe, or maybe he was unlucky, because you're going to have to figure that out after you read the book. You've got to read this book, people. This is so cool. Now, Max goes to the chair takes him and he disappears, and he says that they have him in Munich. But how did you decide, this is so cool, to blindside him on the train and introduce him to Katerina, who was, we realized, was like Mary, Max had been hidden talents and shades, yeah. So how did he realize, he didn't realize he was being blindsided, did he, or did he? Or did he just go along with her? She was a really powerful character.
Thank you. Yeah, I love Katerina. I would love to do just a book or a series just with her. She's in all of these books. She mm-hmm. appears now and then, and she's Harry's former lover, and she is, I think the women in most of my books are this way. She's basically smarter than the men. She knows instinctively what's
yes,
right, and she knows what to go after. And basically, I did blindside Max, and I was thinking about why I did it and how, and I think it's one of those things that happens when you're writing. I don't think I had outlined it this way. I think you know, just her character pretty much forced herself into the story because, as you know, at this point, Max really needs help. He's had all his options taken away from him, and he's been sent home back to Munich, told he can't look for Harry any longer. But then suddenly on in the middle of the night train, here appears Katerina, and she says, hey, you know, are you with me or not? Let's go find Harry. And I can get into this if you want. So Katerina was also, like Max, an actor and an entertainer.
Mm.
Unlike Max, she actually achieved great success during the war as a star of stage and screen, but now she's trying to make amends for what Germany did during the war, and she's very, very serious about it, as you know from reading the book.
Mm-hmm.
So they both kind of team up as this weird, you know, in another world they'd be teaming up for a show, but in this world they're using their acting talents for espionage and you know, covert activities, that kind of thing. So Katerina is kind of the one who sort of jumpstarts Max's efforts and gives him new hope.
That is very true. And everybody, just read the title. You'll get it. So how did she know about Harry? And how did you create the scenes where they wind up? How did they survive the terrains and the weather? I mean, I felt like I needed something to cover me up because I was getting freezing just reading the book. I was frozen.
Yeah, well, luckily it's spring in the book, and I think I actually had moved it up into spring because of that very reason.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they use a series of connections they have and safe houses, and at one point early on, they hole up in a barn where Katerina proves her mettle to Max in a very, very forceful way. She reduces a threat very quickly. But, you know, but all of them, because of the various things they went through, especially Max during the war on the front lines, they're sort of used to operating under harsh conditions at this point. But, yeah, it's not fun. It's cold, and it's, you know, you go without food and all that. But to go back to Katerina and Harry, Katerina has her, without giving too much away, Katerina has her own way of finding out things to keep things moving. And she found out about Harry from another former flame of Harry's, who Sabina, who works for the United Nations Relief Organization in the same region. And since Katerina now is working for the Israelis, there's a Palestine connection between the two because the United Nations relief people were sending refugees to Palestine and, you know, were capable of creating paperwork and that kind of thing. So Sabina had basically tipped Katerina off that Harry was in trouble. He was he's behind the Iron Curtain, and Katerina figures out that Max is on his trail. And as we know, we can talk about this a little bit further if you want, but Katerina has kind of dual agendas here. She really wants to help find Harry and Max, but she also has her own agenda that plays out later in the end of the book.
Well, you're going to find out if you read the book, and those people that don't read it, you're going to be disappointed because this is one of my picks. I pick every month, I pick a few books that I like. Usually it's about 10 that I read, maybe more. You never know. And I just list them on my, this is what Fran picks, but this one's from Just Reviews. And actually people do read what I write because I put it, if you put your stuff on LinkedIn, you're going to get a lot of hits. Put it on Facebook, don't even worry about it. Put it on Twitter, you're going to get a lot of hits. But on LinkedIn, maybe 200 people read what I write in 5 minutes, which is great for the authors. So, every stop of the journey, this was really cool. Different safe houses, different countries, different places, different scenes. So how did you create that? And what happens when they finally find Harry? I don't know about Harry. I don't know about this guy.
Well, Harry's very, you know, like I was saying, Harry's very headstrong. Ironically, he thinks of himself as this very American can-do kind of guy because he came of age in America and all that. But he's honestly, I think of him as more German than Max because he's almost German in this old school Prussian kind of way. He's very confident and kind of stubborn. And, you know, he still thinks he's going to change the world, but he's willing to make compromises at this point. And that involves, as you say, a lot of these, countries and safe houses and places and scenes. And, Fran, I love this stuff. I love creating settings and scenes. I love creating an atmosphere. And, you know, a lot of that comes from research. I mean, thank God for the internet because you can do so many things these days, you know, including, you know, you can use Google Maps to go down a street if you want to, really. And I've probably read way too many espionage novels from the era, which, you know, I'm probably borrowing from those. But I have another angle here that I realized that has kind of influenced this. When I was young, really young and naive, just coming out of college as an history undergrad, the Berlin Wall came down. And I could think of nothing better to do with my life than save my money, get back to Europe, and, visit some of this history before it went away. So I got over there in the spring of 1990, and I was there for about 6 months and staying with friends and things, but I ventured into Eastern Europe for as long as I could for part of that. And I went to some of these places. I was in East Berlin when it was still, you know, East Germany. I was in Prague when it was still, you know, communist Czechoslovakia. I was in Poland. I went to Krakow, and I also, because of my debt to history, I went to Auschwitz camp. I was in Budapest, and I was on what was then the Yugoslavian coast. And, I mean, a lot of these places looked like they could have been 1955. But, you know, there was no Western advertising yet. The buildings were, you know, they weren't cleaned. They were still gray. A lot of them had bullet holes in them.
Oh, God.
It was like a time machine, and I felt like one of the few Westerners. I certainly looked like it. But it's funny, Fran, because I realize looking back now, we didn't have any way to communicate back then, anything like today. So I could have easily gone missing for various reasons, and no one would have known where I was at all. So I think that kind of influenced this route a little bit because it kind of just came back in my mind.
Did you take pictures? I mean, how did you film when you were there? My grandmother was brutalized in Dachau. And my other grandmother was in a Polish concentration camp. And then they had experiments in sterilization. I didn't know this until after she died, and then one day she just sat down and told me, I was like, if I could take their faces and, you know. So how did you feel when you were there? That must have been, especially Auschwitz and Dachau and all of the prison camps, what they did to these people.
Well, I've been to Dachau a couple times because I lived in Munich, and of course it's very disturbing. And I just want to say I'm sorry for your relatives. You know, the people from that era, they held so much in and didn't share their thoughts, and, you know, probably for good reason. Such horrible things. But I have to say that I saw, I've seen Dachau and a couple other places like that, but nothing prepared me for Auschwitz. It was,
I could imagine.
The Auschwitz most people see is the smaller early camp, Auschwitz 1, but the camp with the gate that is in movies and all that is Auschwitz 2, and that was built down the road as this massive sprawling camp that seems to go to the horizon. And even then in 1990, the Polish government did a really good job of rebuilding some of it. But me and my friend were pretty much the only people there. We wandered the camp, and I had a camera with me, and I was taking pictures in the other places I was at. Not a lot, but I didn't even feel like I should take pictures there. I took a couple, but one of the most disturbing things is it's still there today. In a far corner of the camp, there's a, not to get too grim, but there's a pond of ashes and you can tell. I mean, it's horrible stuff. So I'll get off that subject, but
They never, ever, ever, there was just no remorse, nothing. He just, and the fact that all these people went and did whatever he said is even sicker. That worries me today, too. So what happens when they find Harry, and how do they connect?
Yeah, so that is, you know, it's the same sort of thing. I don't want to make it too easy.
Don't give it away.
My characters. Well, they're not quite finding Harry. He's eluding them at this point. So Katerina, because of her contacts, they have a plan B, and it's this Soviet intelligence man who's willing to talk to her. And at this point, they're in, I believe it's Dresden, East Germany. And there's this scene where they wait for him to make contact, and I love it. I loved writing it. I didn't plan it. Mm-hmm. It just happened. It's basically a bizarro Soviet version of the Cuckoo Club that Max owns in Munich, and it's very rowdy, not jazz music, kind of, you know, Eastern European music and all that. And through this kind of rowdy atmosphere, they make contact, and this man tips them off and keeps them going. To where eventually they find Harry.
But Harry is an enigma. That's all I have to say. Harry was an enigma. And at one point I wanted to hit him, and I go like, what? And it took a while before everything was settled. So tell us about there was a scientist, Harry said. And he needed to find the scientist. How come? And why did he track? Why did he want to track him down?
Yeah, Max also wants to hit Harry on the head because he's so stubborn. But you know, Harry, as you find out, he has really good reasons for doing what he's doing. He's trying to find an American scientist who is supposedly abducted by the Soviets and is being held in what they find out to be Poland. And through a series of contacts and things, they make it into across the river from East Germany, the town of Görlitz, into the Poland side of that. And they find him in another interesting thing that I found out in my research is that in this part of Poland, right over the river from Germany in communist Poland, smack dab in the middle of nowhere, was this giant enclave of Greek communist refugees, and they basically created their own, like, small version of Greece because they were refugees from the civil war in Greece at the time. So Stanley Samaras, who is the scientist, he's an American of Greek extraction, he's somewhat comfortable there because of the Greek connection. And they're a little bit surprised, especially Harry, that, you know, Stanley Samaras isn't kept in a cell or a cage or forced to work. Stanley is somewhat operating with, you know, free movement. He has an apartment. They're watching him. They're eyeing him. And they have to decide, you know, what's their next move. And I can get into that, the first encounter, if you want.
Well, that was one of the questions that I have in front of me. was their first encounter? And Harry is astute, but Max sees things very clear. I've told them I'm too perceptive, so I see things too clear, they said. Very bad. So he tries to figure out Katerina, and then Harry tells him about the scientists. So what happens when they finally meet the scientists? And there's a surprise there, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think I can phrase this in a way that doesn't give too much away.
No,
Stanley,
don't.
You know, he's not an idiot either. He's naive in other ways, clearly. But he senses that someone's watching him, so he finds a way to sort of lure Harry and Max and Katerina into kind of a safe area where they can meet without anyone seeing them. And from then, you know, they have to figure out together what they're going to do and, you know, how engaged Stanley is. And Max, at this point, you know, he seems like he's sort of just going along with Harry and helping Harry and paying attention. But Max, partially I think because he really just wants people to get along and all that, he's become a really good judge of people. And also because he had been naive in his own way in the past and isn't anymore, he's able to kind of judge that, you know, Stanley Samaras and Katerina as well both sort of have their own agendas, and it's not quite what Harry was expecting to get out of the deal, and it's gonna force them to adjust their plans altogether.
Well, there's another character on the back cover. I'd be really remiss if I didn't say former Nazi Hartmut Diaz, now an agent of East German intelligence. But where does he fit in, and how does the scientists really feel about America? Because you get like a conflicting thing about him. But Diaz is a good character. I like him.
Oh, good. It's hard to write unlikable people with bad agendas in a way that people won't follow. So I'm glad you said that. Hartmut Dietz is actually a character from the previous book, Lost Kin. He did some horrible things in that, which made him flee to East Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So now he has cropped up again, and he's making things even harder for Max, and then Max and Harry in their efforts, because Dietz has his own agenda as well. He appears to be kind of working his way up the tiny ladder in the East German, the fledgling East German security service, which is basically run by the Russians. It's kind of what became the Stasi. But Dietz is a former Nazi. He has, oh, I can't give too much away here, friend. He has his own agenda, let's say, and he's going to make things even more complicated for everyone involved, even though they hate his guts. But he's going to force them to compromise in the final solution they come up with to get Stanley Samaras out of there.
This is interesting. Now, they want to take him back to America, right? But you get a conflicting feeling. There are two sides. So what is his gripe with America? And what is he claims the Americans are planning to create? And what about the Russians? So you don't get a straight picture from him. You've been into wondering, like, should I bother with him? Does he really want to go to America? Or does he really want to stay here?
Yeah, Stanley's a very conflicted character. I think it's okay to say he's a biological germ warfare expert. There was a biological weapons race going on in the early Cold War, and that meant that both sides, the Soviets and the Western Allies, the U.S. and the British, were trying to secure any scientists for themselves. And unfortunately, that also involved former Nazi scientists that both sides wanted. Stanley is not one of those, but he is definitely someone, because of his knowledge, that Harry wants to get back to America. Stanley, to me, is a very interesting character because he's sort of, like I said, he's conflicted. He grew up in America. He's all-American guy, likes baseball, going to the diner and all that. But he also believes that, or has been led to believe, I should say, that the Americans and the British are the real perpetrators of these germ warfare efforts. And he's, by this point, he's not sure that he's was working for the right side when he was working for the Americans. So he's feeling this sort of tug of war between, you know, Soviet influence and his American kind of former patriotism. He's kind of an idealist, stupidly idealist, kind of like Harry and Max used to be. And so Max especially sees that, and he sees that, like himself, Stanley Samaras has been led to believe, that...
How did you create the title
that the
of
Americans,
each chapter?
Oh, what's that?
How did you create the titles for each chapter? Because each chapter sort of puts you on edge, especially the one that's titled Ratline. I'm looking through the book now, and I'm saying, like, every chapter either puts you somewhere, or you know that what you have a feeling that something's going to happen, and it's like a time. And then you have the truth, you have a whole bunch that I'm looking at. I'm saying, like, wait a minute. And then some of them, they actually put them in a specific place. So how did you decide to tell the reader sort of where the story is taking place and what time period? But the one that's Ratline is really good.
Oh, thank you. It's that kind of ticking clock, you know. You can see that time's running out. And also the other, there's a practical reason, is that they were jumping around so much. I wanted to make sure that the reader knew where they were at a given time.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad that works for you. I didn't have that originally, and I put it in a rewrite because I really felt it would help. And my copy editor ended up thanking me for doing it, which was really
I have to thank you for doing it because it made it so much easier to read. But before I forget, Wednesday, the author of Rise to Rebellion will be here. On the 26th, a really great new author. His name is Matt Cost, Pirate Trap. On the 2nd, I am so honored, New York Times author Adam Sykes, The Underhanded. On the 8th, Dr. Gloria Mitchell will talk about her Garbage Man series and the book that's called I Trust Him. And on the 10th, this is what I do with my reading license and my reading degrees. On the 10th, Dr. George Cavuto, who's the most authority in reading, and I are going to talk about iatrogenics in psychology and how to relate iatrogenics disorders in reading disorders and in education. That's my topic for the day. And if you want to know more about it, you have to listen, because he tells me the topic and I get to do the research. Also get to ask the questions and answer them at times. So that should be interesting. That's what's coming up next month. Now, tell us about how you unravel the different lies and deceptions within each character that leads to an ending that says to me, oh my God, and in harsh truth. How did you do that?
Well, yeah, it's kind of like I was saying, Max, it, before in the book one, he was naive and was led to believe certain things that sent him in the wrong direction. And in this book, it's time, you know, but for Stanley, what he slowly discovers is that Stanley sort of thought he was making up his own mind about things, but Max helps him because he's a people person. Max helps Stanley realize that he was being worked. He was being influenced by certain friends of the Soviets back home. Mm. And, you know, it's that oldest trick in the book. The Soviet perpetrators were making Stanley believe that what the bad things the Americans were doing are actually the things that they themselves are doing. And, you know, we see that thing still surviving today all the time. And so it's this tense period in the Cold War. The Soviets have now become enemy number one. And Stanley, there's also a love interest that makes things even harder, and it makes the realization that not everything is what it seems, you know, even more bitter. So Stanley's kind of, you know, he's kind of a strange guy. He lashes out and then he sulks. So it's kind of hard to keep him in line as they move to get him out of there. And that will of course complicate the ending further.
It did. I had tissues. Seriously. I go like, oh my God, after all of that, what can I say? Well, where did sleep wind up at the end too? It says, Max knows a performance when he sees one. Harry said, can I just tell Sleep? Is he allowed to tell him what's really going on? And what happens with Dietz and Katarina?
Oh.
I like Katarina. She's evil.
Thank you. Me too. I like what she does. She's pulling
her punches. Yeah, she's evil. I like her too, yeah.
I can't. Don't give too much away for the readers, but
no.
I think it sounds like it was a fairly satisfying conclusion for you, where Katarina dealt with.
We don't know where she's going to be.
in her own special way. Let's just say.
She sort of makes her point in every chapter. And as I'm reading about her, I'm going like, really, that's interesting. Oh, really, nice. That's even more interesting. And she had a way of getting people to just sort of go along with her, which is rare too.
I'm glad you noticed that. Yeah, she's always watching the whole time, and she's, you know, she picks her moments very specifically and makes her moves very specifically at the right moment. So, Katarina's great. Hopefully I can bring her back.
Well, we don't know. There's so many chapters here, and like you said, other times, you know, being at 8:30, whatever p.m., so I pretty much could picture it, like close your eyes and say, okay, it's nighttime. What am I looking at? It's probably during the day. What am I looking at? And you can tell. But this is a question that's not on my page, but I have to ask it. The cover sort of says it all. How did you decide on the cover of this book? Because it definitely defines the title in a way.
Brand, I'm so glad you asked that question, and here's why. The original version of the cover only had the two men. But it's basically Harry in the background and Max in the foreground, trailing him. And my publisher's great. They gave me input on the design and with the designer, and I said, we got to get Katarina in there because she's another level. You know, she really knows what she's doing. If Max thinks he knows what he's doing, you know, she's even better. So she's waiting. She's watching. She has sort of this cape on that she's wearing, you know, as they travel through Czechoslovakia and other places. And I love the look of it with the shadows and the big font. It reminds me of the period. Thank you for mentioning that cover.
Well, you sort of don't know who she is until you start to read, but you know that she's important. And I'm saying she looks like her eyes are straightforward, yet she can see both men, and you don't know what's going through her head while she's standing there. And besides the fact that it's an eerie scene with, like, fog you can't see, so you can't even tell if anybody else is hiding there. So that made it even more alert to the title, Lines of Deception. That's sort of, like, connected even more. That's just my...
Yeah, I think so. I'm constantly amazed by cover designers, how they interpret the story. And, you know, it's a hard job, just in a really brief image, concise image, just showing as much as they can about the story, for sure. And I tend to, I think I mentioned this earlier, I tend to write sort of visually, I try to, so that it sets you in the place without going on forever. I think part of that comes from I used to write screenplays. And
oh, nice.
So I really enjoy doing that. And if anything, I learned from screenplays was that in showing instead of telling, and also, you know, dialogue, of course.
I'm not good at dialogue. I write from the point of view of the dead body with somebody that deserves to do something behind the gravestone. My last book, In the Mirror Image, I actually tried to write with a little dialogue. I had some help from my editor, finally. And it means if you look in the mirror and your face is looking at the mirror, you've done something wrong. The mirror is going to play what you did wrong. If you don't correct yourself, you're going to be winding up as a face in the mirror, replaying it forever. And it's different. I got some mixed reviews, but the cover sort of says it with a mirror that's really scary. But this is really, like, even the buildings, you can't tell if they're dilapidated. You can't really tell where she is or where they are just by looking at the cover, so you don't know. So you're going to have to read it, people. So when the story closes, we wonder, where are they going to wind up? So if you decide to write another one for me so I could read it, and find out what happens next. Would they both wind up together, or is Harry going to do his thing again?
Yeah, that's actually a tough one for me because book one is told in book one's told in Max's point of view. Book two is told in Harry's point of view, and they're actually on their own doing their thing. And then book three is them together, and this book is them together. I want to put them together in the fourth book. That question comes up, you know, what actual point of view should I have? Should I have both of them? In this book, you mentioned Katarina. I did not use her point of view because I wanted her to be
so
sort
thinking.
Of mysterious. Yeah, because I don't want you to know too much about what she's up to. That too can be compelling, but it's a choice. And I really want to put them together again. I am working with something, an idea that's set in the very early West German government, which was based in Bonn, Germany, instead of, you know, Berlin, of course, which separated. With the Red Scare heating up and all that, there was a lot of, in the early West German government, there was actually a lot of intrigue and espionage intrigue going on because Nazis being Nazis, they were trying to creep their way back into positions of power, you know, saying that they were rehabilitated or even using different names. And then there's this whole kind of Soviet influence at the same time. And the Americans and British are, you know, getting worked a little bit by the Nazis and the Soviets. So there's something there for sure. And I have an idea. I just got to find the time to work on it, of course.
No, I have faith that you're going to work on it. What bothers me is that, I mean, I studied the World War II. I had different viewpoints of the war. And I had different viewpoints of why we didn't come in to help the people there, why they waited till the very end. And there were so many people in these concentration camps, it was almost as if it's okay. And then when they say that 6 million people weren't killed, you really get angry. I went to the Holocaust Museum. I could have closed, but I had to close my eyes. That's all I could think about.
Yep.
Is that my grandmother was part of this. My other grandmother came from Russia to America, and she lost her whole family in Dachau, and she was bitter forever. I don't think I've seen my grandmother smile ever in her whole life. So you wonder how did people in the world, even today, they don't believe that it will happen. So maybe a book about the beginning would be something important for people to understand.
Oh, that's a good idea. I there's, you know, fiction lets you get at certain truths in ways that nonfiction doesn't always allow, and so there could be something there. I mean, having visited these places and seen these things documented, I think there's a special place in hell for people who deny that it happened. It clearly did, and it should never happen again.
Mm-hmm. I agree. But really got me. I mean, my husband was watching something about Germany and Hitler and all the other days, and I wanted to throw something at the television because I couldn't stand to look the sight
mm-hmm.
of him. I can't. Oh,
yep.
It's just that how did all of these people? I'm sure you came across it in your research. How did all these German people and all the other countries that were with him? How did they just believe everything he said? And no one went up against him because they were scared to death that they were going to get killed. How does this one man yield all this power, and just because he thought he could? That's what's really scary. He literally brainwashed everything. Talk about deception on the whole world. That's what really scared me. How does somebody do that? And why do people, the whole German country, seriously, go along with him and nobody did anything about it? That's scary.
Yeah. It's a huge question. Yeah, even today, I mean, he wasn't really that charismatic. He his voice was horrible. He was the unfortunate wrong place, I guess, at the wrong time. And he made all these people feel like they were victims and that they had to get revenge and, you know, they'd been done wrong and they took it to horrible extremes. So I'll never quite understand it.
That's what happens when people are naive and believe what they want to believe. Sometimes they just go along
with,
yeah, you're right, okay, this is right. And that's what's really scary. And I'm looking at page 183. I think I have this book memory. I just want you to know that your book gave me eye strain because I just sat down and read it, which is a good thing. Sort of.
Sorry, I think.
I got the eye drops out afterwards, but I got eye strain because I couldn't put it down. So what are the Nazi rat lines? What does that mean? Nazi rat lines being the fugitive Nazi escape routes? I mean, how did they create those?
Yeah, rat lines were a real thing. They existed. You know, I have a few things that really exist in this book, and that's one of them. They helped Nazi fugitives escape to South America and elsewhere.
Mm.
They often passed through fascist Spain and often even through the Vatican. The Catholic Church was, we found out more recently, way more helpful than everyone wanted to believe. But the unfortunate part of the Cold War is there's also evidence that the Americans actually ended up using the rat lines for, you know, their own intelligence operations, and that comes into play in the book. But yeah, they're a real thing. We even use them to get Nazi scientists and military experts before the Soviets snatched them. I guess we had to use what we could, you know, a moment of expediency.
My grandfather, because my grandmother wasn't my real grandmother, she was my step-grandmother, I didn't find out till later. My grandmother was in Dachau, and the other sisters, I'm not sure where they were, but he went to the Polish underground to get them to come to America. That had to be amazing, that he actually was able to go back to Poland. My real grandmother was at home, and he got the other sisters out through the Polish underground. So there was so much, and yet I wonder sometimes, maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, that America took a blind eye, and so did a lot of other countries take a blind eye to what was happening until they had to wake up and see that was happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. There's lots of evidence that we could have done more. We also didn't allow ships in of Jewish refugees who were trying to get out. It's a sad, long, sad tale. I didn't know about your family. That's terrible.
It is. My grandfather sort of told me this story, but my grandmother did. My mother never knew that I knew that my grandmother was my step-grandmother until she died. Until somebody said to my mother, my mother went to movies with her, with my cousin, and she says, Mama's going to wait. She says, well, you don't have to tell her. She's not your real mother. My mother never said anything, ever. She never told her that she knew, because my grandmother was, there was nobody better than her, and perceptive like you wouldn't believe. She was, because of what they did to her, she had cataracts. She couldn't see. So I didn't know why she used to drag me with her to the butcher, because the butcher man thought she was cute, so I had to protect her from the butcher. But she used to count her steps. So people realize. And then when you hear the anti-Semitism and the hate, it doesn't matter just Jewish, anybody, in the schools, I got worried, like, what are these kids going to grow up to be? Are they going to grow up to be the same thing? That's what's even scarier.
Yeah, and you know, why aren't they instructed about the truths of it in more effective ways? It's what I always wonder.
Well, tell us where we can find out all about you and your work. And you know something, this would be really, I do panel shows if I get 5 minutes anywhere. For anybody having a book that's coming out, talk to me in August. I have absolutely no dates for interviews until August. I'm booked. I can't believe it. That many people want to be on my show, which is great. But if anybody has anything, but this would be really a great topic for a panel, for people that do research about different countries, or even about Germany, whatever. Because I like doing things that are different, not just talking about books. So where can we find out more about you and your work?
Yeah. So the easiest way is. I should preface this by saying there are lots of Steve Andersons in the world. So if you search for me, you know, maybe do it with writer or author or something. Because of all the Steve Andersons in the world, my website name is based on my full name, which is my full name is Stephen Frederick Anderson. And so because of that, my website is Stephen with a PH, the letter F, which stands for Frederick, and then Anderson, S-O-N. So StephenFAnderson.com. And that has everything you want there. It's got all my books. And most importantly, it has a sign up for my newsletter, which I do regularly. And it's not just, you know, my books are on sale or I have a book out. I do lots of things about every 3 weeks, a little bit about my books, but there's also some hidden history and writing tips and book picks and things like that. So you can sign up right there on the main page. And those are the two things to know, really. I guess I should say I have as part of this, I have another book coming out in July.
Oh, good. When?
It's early July, and it's a new direction for me. It's a psychological thriller, actually, set in the present day.
Oh, nice.
The little log line from the publisher is, it's titled Show Game, and the log line is, a mysterious vigilante abducts powerful abusers and exposes them online in a twisted show game in this psychological thriller. So that's coming this year, too.
You have to send it to me. I love psychological thrillers. I love psychological thrillers. They're my they're like my favorite. But anyway, this has been really, you just cheered me up the whole morning. And I want to thank you.
Even with talk of the Holocaust and Iron Curtain, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
This is real. I did. I love Lines of Deception. For those of you that didn't get the book, go on Amazon and get it. I will be posting your review in Just Reviews later today. And I will. Unfortunately, Amazon doesn't love me anymore. Somebody hacked into my account. So I will post the five stars on Goodreads. No problem. And I will post.
I appreciate that.
I will post the review on LinkedIn, and I guarantee. I just got an email from them that one of my reviews got over 506 views. I have no idea.
Great.
People are really, really. I don't know why, but they are reading it. So thank you so much, and I'm glad I got the time today finally. Everybody, it's a beautiful day outside. It's how many degrees out here? Oh, only 38. It's warm. Not bad. It's 38 degrees here. I don't know how warm it is where you are, but it's cold here. Everybody have a great day. Stay safe, and bye.
Thank you, Fran. I appreciate it very much. Have a good day.